keeping democracy alive with Bert Cohen.
Check for pulse.
Stand clear. Push to shock.
So yes, there's a huge gap between public opinion and public policy. That people don't feel that they can do very much.
You know what this is? This is a very Hamiltonian system. Alexander Hamilton being the guy here in a very un-Jeffersonian.
In the case of the Republicans, it's dramatically the opposite. But even in the case of the Democrats.
An absolute typhoon of terror against African Americans in the South.
America's fascists are those people who think that Wall Street comes first and the American people come second.
Really seen as a financial sector that's gotten out of hand.
The shooting, the violence, that is not the drug problem. That is, in fact, the drug policy problem.
I speak tonight for the dignity of man.
We're calling Paris, France today. This is America. Nobody here likes fascists. We lost hundreds of thousands of young patriots in the war to crush fascism some 70 years ago in World War II. Now the word fascism is back. It has come to mean white supremacists and those who would take away our traditional constitutional rights, such as free speech and freedom of the press, people who favor a police state in America. Many of the people who gathered at the hate rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, would be called fascists. So all traditional Americans, of course, want to fight and defeat the new fascists. Grabbing the attention of concerned people has been a seemingly loose bunch of violent young men calling themselves Antifa for anti-fascist, an easy and intentionally simple label quickly understood. If you are against fascism, you'll probably support them and cheer them on, right? I mean, if you are against Antifa, doesn't that mean you support fascism in America? Well, as H.L. Mencken put it, to every complex problem, there's a simple solution, and it's wrong. Political energy is not limitless. To effectively and successfully fight the dangers to America like Trump and the powers behind him, it is crucial that we have a good understanding of who the real enemy is and how best to actually defeat them. For example, you, the listener, may have heard of Richard Spencer, a white supremacist who claims to have created the term alt-right. At the inauguration of Donald Trump, someone spotted Spencer and punched him hard in the head. And that may have felt good, but really, what did it accomplish? Some in Antifa would absolutely already say that since I question that, well, I must be a fascist sympathizer. Which is nuts, of course. America is certainly endangered by the rise of white supremacists and neo-fascists, but reacting from the gut may not be the smartest way to fight them. Our guest today, Diana Johnstone, who was in Paris, has written an essay in Counterpunch titled Antifa in Theory and in Practice. Diana Johnstone, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Well, hello from over here.
Well, Diana Johnstone is the author of The Politics of Euromissiles, Europe in America's World, Fool's Crusade, Yugoslavia and NATO, and Western Definitions, Delusions, I should say, and Queen of Chaos, The Misadventures of Hillary Clinton. She's author of the introduction and conclusion to her father's memoirs, published this year by Clarity Press, as From Mad to Madness, Inside Pentagon Nuclear War Planning. Johnstone was active in the movement against the Vietnam War, as was I, organizing the first international contacts between American citizens and Vietnamese representatives. Most of Johnstone's adult life has been spent in France, Germany, and Italy. Wonderful. She's in Paris now. Well, again, thanks for being with us. Your essay starts off with a quote from Italian writer and co-author of Fellini's stuff, Ennio Flaiano. I hope I pronounced it right. Maybe I didn't. He says, "Fascists are divided into two categories, the fascists and the anti-fascist." Please tell us why you used that quote. What does it mean?
Well, I thought it would focus on the fact that the so-called anti-fascists behave more like fascists these days than anybody else. I mean, the whole thing of deciding we've got to shut somebody down by punching him in the face. I mean, this is sort of a fascist behavior. The fascists were characterized by stopping people from expressing other opinions and using violence, and that's what the Antifa do. Over here, we pronounce it Antifa.
Antifa, Antifa, whatever. It's the same bunch of people. So interesting. Yes, they use violence to intimidate people and to scare people and to have power over people. That's not what non-fascists do. That's what fascists do. And you write...
No, exactly. I'll add this, you know. I mean, they have fascist tactics and not much else. Because, of course, they claim to want a world revolution where everything will be marvelous, but they haven't the slightest idea how to accomplish that. So actually, all they are is tactics, and those tactics are fascist tactics.
Ah, that's a good point. All they are is tactics. Gosh, you're right. And it attracts a lot of people. You write that despite its imported European name, Antifa is basically just another example of America's steady decline into violence. Say more about that, please.
Well, yes, because it seems that the last election, looking at it from here, has driven a lot of America simply crazy. I mean, they can't understand why Trump won. And they don't really try to examine that question. They just freak out because this awful man won the election. They don't start to think that he is a perfect expression of what America has become. I mean, he's rich, vulgar, egotistical. He really is an image of what the American political system has become when it depends mainly on money. People don't have much choice. One reason you could say, why did people vote for Trump? Because they didn't have much choice. I mean, that's all. You get two candidates who are widely detested.
Yes.
And one of them gets less votes than the other. But that's all that happens. And you should be looking at what's wrong with the whole system rather than just say, oh, well, if we get rid of Trump, everything will be fine. Because
yeah.
It won't.
That's for sure. As many people have said, Trump is really a symptom of the problem. Yeah, he's a problem, but he's also a symptom of a much bigger problem. And he is not down on violence. You know, there's a new book I wanted to, which you talk about a little bit here, which is reported to be selling well, called Antifa, the Anti-Fascist Handbook. Its author is a young man. Funny how all these Antifa people are young men. And this guy is named Mark Bray. The book intends to examine the history of the growth of fascism. There's been a lot of fascism over on your side of the pond there in Europe. How accurate is his history of the growth of fascism? And what dangers might a misunderstanding present?
Well, I read his book quite carefully because I didn't want to criticize things without really studying them. And I think part of it must have been one of his PhD thesis or something, because he interviewed a lot of self-styled antifas in the United States and in Europe. And, well, the interviews add up to the fact that these people boast about how they went and beat somebody up. I find it very similar to if somebody went to Los Angeles and interviewed members of gangs. Except that the gangs get to be more violent, actually. But the sort of male will show them we're tougher than they are,
right,
is pretty much similar to that. I mean, there's no politics there. There's really no politics there, except great declarations that we're going to stop fascism, which, of course, they won't. They can't. I mean, that is absolutely the worst way you could go about stopping fascism, which is to go on their terrain,
yes,
which they're going to be better at. Believe me, if you're going to have the contest be who is tougher, they'll win.
Of course. And I find it interesting how, well, the left is always divided. And as my old friend, who you probably knew too, Abby Hoffman, used to say, the relationship between the left and right is perfect. The left is masochistic. The right is sadistic. You know, and it works out perfectly that way. And
that applies.
Well, the people, I've talked to people who are pretty angry, of course, at what's happened to America, and talk about a revolution, which does oftentimes involve violence. But it seems to me, I mean, the other side has lots of guns, lots of weapons. They're tremendously organized. You know, they have the whole huge military-industrial complex. Fighting them with violence is just, it's stupid. I'm sorry. It's just stupid. It really is. And, you know, fascism in Europe grew out of a lot of actual political things. I mean, you know, there's the politics of the wealthy industrialists there who supported the fascists, you know, and manipulated a sense of populism as they are doing here. And it's punching the, you know, street level fascists in the nose. That plays right into their hands. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. We are keeping democracy alive. Our guest today is in beautiful Paris. Diana Johnstone has written an essay and Counterpunch, Antifa in Theory and Practice. And she is familiar with something that I am quite familiar with, too. It has to do with fighting fascism effectively. I have been a longtime member of the Board of Governors of the Abraham Lincoln Brigade Archives, which is... men and women, black and white, who fought together to fight the fascists in the Spanish Civil War. And I do take offense at this author Mark Bray's claim to be carrying on the tradition and even claim the mantle of those brave men and women from America who fought the fascists in the Spanish Civil War in the 1930s. As you write, the Lincoln Brigade was part of the International Brigades, volunteers from around the world who fought an organized defense, well, they did have their disagreements within them, of the legitimate Republic of Spain. There was a Republic of Spain which was attacked by invading fascist armies led by Francisco Franco, with the help of Hitler and Mussolini. As you write, some of that esteem for the volunteers who fought the fascists is supposed to rub off on their self-designated heirs. Please say more about that. I find that fascinating and disturbing.
Well, I call that innocence by association as opposed to the guilt by the association which they practice on others. I mean, by saying that they are the heirs to the... I mean, it's so pretentious. It's so pretentious. You see, you can learn from history, but you don't learn from history that there are the good and the bad, and we've got to fight the, we got to get out in the street and fight the bad because we're the good. I mean, that's not the kind of lesson you can draw from history. The Spanish Civil War was, of course, a very complicated affair, yes, with a lot of international repercussions and so on. And but the one thing you don't draw from it is the kind of lesson that Mark Bray wants to draw from it. And of course, that was part of a real cause. It was a real political cause, yes, that was all that fit in the times, which were to stop the growth of also of military aggression. You see, one of the things that the Antifa seem to forget about, they don't seem to know what fascism really means. It means violence, not only in the world. Fascism means conquering other countries, and that's exactly what the United States is doing. You know, if they want to stop fascism, they should make the United States stop attacking defenseless countries all over the world. I mean, that's the equivalent. I don't like to keep using the word fascism because I like to be more precise in terminology. Mm. And, of course, fascism just now means anything is bad that you don't like. Unfortunately, we don't have a very good vocabulary to describe the various evils that we're faced with. And in particular, we don't have a proper term for the United States aggressive war machine. But it's not exactly fascist. Fascist, right, was a mass movement that thrived in the age of mass industrialization, where you had crowds, basically. Now we have a very individualistic society, and it's communications that decides things, not fist fights in the street.
Yeah.
The whole situation is very different.
Boy, that is... Yes, I'm here. That is for sure. No question about that. And fascism, you know, the people of Germany after the First World War were living in a terrible situation. They were really angry. They didn't know what to do. And along came this fascist leader. And, you know, I tell you, if you were to ask the average American what fascism means, very few people have any idea. They know it sounds bad, but there are an awful lot of people within the 21st century Republican Party who would say they're against fascism. But as it said in the introduction to the show here, fascism in America is people who think Wall Street comes first and the American people come second. Fascism is authoritarianism. You know, it's no freedoms. They crush freedom of speech. You can't possibly disagree. People don't know what fascism is. It's kind of an ugly name, and it's so attractive for the so-called Antifa and anti-fascist to use that term to recruit people. And it just makes me wonder, they're very unsophisticated. Let's face it, exceedingly unsophisticated, and that is really dangerous. Antifa people insist, as you write, if only anti-fascists had beat up the fascist movements early enough, the latter would have been nipped in the bud. Since reason and debate failed to stop the rise of fascism, they argue, we must use street violence. End of quote. In what ways does violence against fascists actually serve to, as you say, exalt violence and help promote fascism as a bulwark against Bolshevism? Talk about any danger of that happening now. I mean, might people see the violence from Antifa and that result in public calls for strengthening police forces? You know, they see that. Might Antifa help legitimize violence among people who don't know about fascism and people in the middle who are scared of seeing these, you know, black outfitted black box people who are beating up people? Isn't there a real danger of them, you know, public calls for strengthening police action?
It has the effect of strengthening police action and also of weakening left demonstrations. I mean, I see that over here a lot. When there are practically no anti-war demonstrations anymore, but there are labor demonstrations and things like that. And the fact is that the presence of these
thugs
of these black bloc fighters can frighten some people away from the demonstration along with the police. And of course, when the two of them get going, then the whole purpose and meaning of the demonstration is forgotten, and it just becomes a brawl. And of course, it strengthens demands for more police protection. And I mean, if these kids may like to get out and throw things at the police, but if they think that they can defeat the armed forces of a modern state,
yeah.
I mean, what dream world are they living in? It's negative both because it's bad for the sensible people on the left who don't want to get involved in that, and because it strengthens the police. So, I mean, it's doubly harmful.
It's amazed me how on Facebook discussions, people on the right have created this term they call alt-left. There is no alt-left. Okay, there's an alt-right, but it's so convenient for them to say that, well, this is what the left is, Antifa. That's the left, and it only hurts us terribly here because that's not who we are at all. Now, go ahead.
Go on, sorry.
No, you go. Your turn.
No, I think it's a sort of a takeover. I don't know. I'm over here. I'm not over there. From what I see over here, there is every reason to suspect that these foolish people are being encouraged by less foolish people in power. And this whole anti-fa thing seems to have blossomed in the wake of Hillary Clinton's electoral defeat. And it's as if the Democrats, I mean, the fact is that Clintonism can be defined as an effort to kill off the left wing of the Democratic Party.
Yes.
I mean, that's sort of what Clintonism is all about, is to make the Democratic Party into the favorite party of the neoliberal imperialists.
Absolutely.
And they succeeded at that. And so here is another chance for them to kill off what could be the left. You see, there's a possibility that Trump's election could be the occasion to really build a real left against
yes.
all of that. And this is an incredible wild goose chase. You tell the left that to be the left, you've got to go out and fight fascists. This is the best possible way for the Democrats to keep control of the Democratic Party as a right-wing party, because the left will be off doing these silly things, and the Clintonites will retain control of the party.
Hmm. So it just shuts out the so-called left. It's very convenient. I hadn't thought about that, to discredit the left by associating them with Antifa, so that the neoliberals, the people who are, you know, I mean, they represent the same interests as the more traditional Republican Party, you know, the Wall Street, the greed-driven people. It's, you know, they've changed their Democratic Party dramatically and pulled it way to the right. And, you know, the Bernie people, we're trying to bring it back to what we always have been, which is where I am. I'm a traditional Democrat, liberal Democrat, FDR, that kind of thing. So that it serves. That's amazing, really. I hadn't thought about that. They discredit the left as by associating them with the Antifa. Wow.
You see, I think how come this book of Mark Bray immediately got reviews
right.
in the biggest mainstream journals, the Washington Post and the New York Times. Look, I've written three or four books which are quite literate and accurate and not so bad, but they're on the left, and I never got a single review. Never. I mean, those people don't review books that don't say what they want to have people hear.
Uh-huh.
And yet, they rush to publish this book, which supposedly advocates overthrowing absolutely everything and having an anarchist utopia.
Right.
I mean, it's as far left as you can go, and yet they publish that because they're not worried about that far left. They're much more worried about some reasonable criticism
uh-huh.
of the
That's
system.
True. Oh, that is true. There's the term useful idiots. It seems to apply here. Now, when the European fascists were in business in the 1930s, there were no, as far as I know, there were no feminists, no gay rights movement. Today, the Antifa labels people who oppose such progressive social causes as fascists. You describe Antifa as a self-appointed inquisition. Are there dangers of defining fascism too broadly today?
Yeah, that's, you see, simply they don't really have a good definition of fascism. It's just whatever they don't like. They have sort of taken over, although they claim to be in the tradition of communism, having a communist or anarchist revolution. In fact, they end up simply defending the politically correct identity politics canon. You mustn't say this, and you mustn't say that, and that's very bad, because you know a lot of people end up wanting to say something just because they're not supposed to say it. I see that here. There begins to be a revolt against politically correct. It has nothing
yes.
to do with the content of the terms. It's just the fact that people don't like to be constantly told what they have to say. I think the situation is a bit different in the United States, because I think over there you really do have more crazies than there are here.
Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't call them fascists. I'd call them, when you have some over here, and France never has so many of those. I mean, you really don't. It's very rare here. There's more in some other countries. But the United States, you do have these weird characters who paint themselves in swastikas or something like that. I mean, that's very unpleasant.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, they weren't very well brought up by their families, I suppose. This is unpleasant, but it's not a world threat.
Yes,
it's a totally
exactly.
marginalized individuals.
Yeah.
What?
I absolutely agree. They're marginalized completely, as they should be. I find it, I thought this was an interesting observation that you had. As I said, I find it deeply troubling that the right today insists Antifa represents the left. I love your line, you know, they imagine themselves Marxists and communists. You say the masked militants of Antifa seem to be more inspired by Batman than by Karl Marx. I wonder if you could explain that, please.
Well, yeah, because I think there's a lot of imitation that goes on. And I think a lot of popular culture, movies and so on, aims at conditioning people to imitate what they see. I think there's a lot been written about this. These studies of media and film and so on. And sometimes it's been absolutely deliberate. I think a lot of cinema in the 30s and so on, what they had really to show what Americans how they should act, what they should be. And the huge number of violent films in recent, with all the horrible Terminators and, I mean, massacres and American Sniper. I mean, there's so many
amazing
violent role models. Of course, Batman is because the violent role model is supposed to be doing good and protecting people and so on. But this is all absolute fantasy. But you see, there's much more role model of getting out there and fighting evil with your fists and so on than stopping to think. How many heroes in the films or popular culture do you see who stop and think things out and get together with other people to work out something reasonable? I mean, that is not a role model that is in American culture today.
Boy, you're so right. And, you know, what really works is people working together and, you know, working things out, digging into the complex and difficult issues and figuring out what works best. But you're right. I've been amazed at these movies that are just smash them up, blow up movies, just one violent thing after another, and that gets, you know, normalized. And, you know, the Trump people, the real powers, the real dangers, I think, they thrive on that kind of thing. You know, I mean, Trump is saying, well, the only way to deal with North Korea is to blow them up, you know? It's like, people, young men especially, seem to believe that. And I find that very, very frightening. One thing I wanted to ask about is, I am on Medicare, I'm older. You may be older as well.
I am.
These young people could say, well, what do you know? You're so out of it. You're so old. You don't know what's going on here. You're stuck in the 20th century. How do you respond to that?
Well, I'm very pleased with being quite old, because the great thing about being old, if you've been paying attention, is that you have seen how things change, how times change, how the zeitgeist changes.
Yes.
How the spirit of the times. I mean, I can remember, I was a child, and yet I can remember the spirit of the 1930s. I mentioned this in the book on my father's memoirs. I remember what that was like, and how there was so much concern for helping the poor and improving things. And then the war came along, and then suddenly it just changes completely, and we've got to go out and kill the enemy.
Yeah.
And you see, when you're old, you realize that the world isn't always just as it is now or as you are going to make it. That, in fact, history is a very difficult thing to follow. And
yes.
I think the young, I'm not talking about wisdom. Wisdom is a matter of, I think older people can be wiser. But above all, they've seen more. They have more experience.
But young,
and that's a great asset.
I think so, too. And it always disturbs me, you know, young people saying, oh, you don't know, you're from a different era, you know, let us take care of it. They don't want to learn from history. And again,
well, they're trained that way by the advertising industry.
True.
The advertising industry is always saying, oh, new, best, only you now. I mean, you look at the advertising industry is constantly glorifying people who are so ignorant that they will think, oh, this is wonderful, I'll buy it. And I think this thing about youth, of course, youth has energy, physical yeah. energy, of course,
yeah.
sometimes too much of it.
Yes.
But I think you see the wise civilizations, I think Asia, China, and so on, you know, they have respect for old people because they yeah. understand that there's something like experience.
Mm.
And that not a matter of being authoritative about,
right.
but simply consultation, simply exchanging
yes.
Experiences and knowledge. And the youth don't want to do that now because they think that they've been slaughtered into thinking that they know all that they need to know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, even in the '60s, though, you know, we used to say, "Don't trust anyone over 30." Boy, was that wrong. You know, but teenagers, young men in particular, I think, have a proclivity to doing that kind of thing. We know best. And of course, they don't, in my opinion. And thinking of young men, I try to learn a lot about history. I think it's important. And in the First World War, like 1914, when it was just getting started, young British men were in fierce competition to get into the fight. It was a big adventure for many bored young men. And actually, there was one, I read about one young man who was turned down, and he killed himself because he just couldn't face it without being able to go into the glorious adventure of the war. And I wonder now, about what percentage of young men in the Antifa are such innocents seeking wild times and perhaps are unwittingly being manipulated by those who actually know what they're doing. You know, some of the people in this movement, yeah, they know what they're doing and they, you know, they want to beat up these other people because it's so much fun. But I wonder how many, you know, are actually fairly innocent, like the people who wanted to fight in the First World War. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, I think so. I mean, one must never underestimate human error. And of course, most people, I mean, if I look back at when I was 20 or something, I didn't know anything. And I knew more than most people my age, I must say, thanks to my family.
Mm-hmm.
you really don't know much about life then. And you make a lot of mistakes when you're young. And later on, people realize that. But at the time, they can be so sure of themselves because
yeah.
they don't have any measurement. They don't have anything to measure it by.
Yeah, it's
and I do think that there's obviously I think there's a great deal of sincerity in this, but the trouble is that sincerity is sometimes a matter of an absence of self-examination. You see, what's very important, and I think that one gets with age too, is self-criticism. I mean, every idea that one has, that's what's so good about writing, if you do it properly, mm-hmm. is that by writing, you get to criticize your own ideas by looking at them and writing and saying, well, wait, no, it's not quite that.
Mm-hmm.
And you correct yourself. And you see, this instant thing where the main thing people are writing is messages on their smartphones are not using writing for the using its self-critical function the way they should.
Uh-huh. Yeah, interesting point. We need to have that self-criticism and looking at ourselves. And, you know, being impulsive has its moments, I suppose. But usually it's not a good idea. The outcomes of being driven by impulsivity, usually not particularly good. And I have a feeling there's a lot of impulsivity and a lot of emotion on this. Yeah, let's go out and beat up some fascists. Ugh, it's fun. I have speculated, you know, in terms of this, you know, innocent people being manipulated. I have speculated, and I'm curious as to what you think on this, that the right, the real powers behind the white supremacists and the fascists, are covertly funding Antifa and organizing Antifa. I mean, I remember I was at May Day 1971, and we were protesting against the war, and there were agent provocateur who came in and said, yeah, throw rocks at the police, attack the police. And they were, you know, plants. They were from the right, no doubt about it. I wonder how much of this you think is going on now. Are they specifically, I mean, it serves their purposes very, very well. What are your thoughts, Diana?
Well, again, I draw on my experience. In the 1970s, there was a lot of sort of street demonstration stuff. And I was working as a journalist at the time. And I went to sort of cover demonstrations or look at them and so on. And I actually saw somebody dressed like an anarchist chatting with the police and then going out there to throw stones.
Uh-huh. Yep, yep.
And one very funny thing is I was at a demonstration and I was sort of at the Place de la République, and I was sort of watching it from a cafe, and some guy came up and was sort of dragging me, as they say in French, you know, sort of. And he gave me his phone number and at work. And later I called the phone number. I didn't talk to him, but it was at the Ministry of Interior.
Oh, my.
And he was all dressed up to as a casseur, as they call it, someone to go smash things in the police. Oh. So I have actually witnessed with my own eyes these smashers, as they call it here, being part of the police.
Of course.
So I know that exists. In fact, here everybody knows it. The problem is I saw that already before when the Vietnam
Right.
War.
Oh, yeah.
I think there were provocateurs who came in to the movement to try to get people to be violent.
Absolutely.
But you see, the problem is that American political culture, they've never even heard of a provocateur. They don't know what that is.
Mm.
And Europeans are a little bit more sophisticated. I mean, they're getting less so because they're copying the United States. But they're still mostly enough sophisticated to realize that there are such things as provocateur, and that they're very likely to behave in a certain way.
Yes.
And so they're easier to spot here.
Well, they were pretty easy to spot at the May Day thing, I have to say. They had freshly pressed bell bottoms that were a little bit too short. That was a dead giveaway. If they're freshly pressed, yeah, they're not for real. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Boy, it's a lot of effort to keep democracy alive, that's for sure. Our guest today, Diana Johnstone, written an essay in Counterpunch titled Antifa, In Theory and in Practice. We're talking about the dangers of the so-called anti-fascists. And as someone with impeccable left liberal credentials, I find myself agreeing with conservative libertarian Senator Rand Paul on issues of foreign policy. He's quite clearly against wars of imperialism. He is certainly to the right. He's certainly a Republican. He's, you know, anti-choice and bad on most issues. I happen to agree with him on that. My sense is that since I agree with him, you know, that we're against militaristic imperialism, that I might be subject to being labeled a fascist by Antifa. What are your thoughts on that?
That's a very important point. And I think that you've put your finger on a reason why Antifa could be being financed by exactly the people we suspect of manipulating it. Because this, I agree about Rand Paul. I mean, his domestic policies make no sense at all.
No.
To my mind, they don't
right.
just don't make any sense. But he makes tremendous good sense on foreign policy. He just tells it like it is, just straight out.
Yep.
And And there's no reason for anti-war people not to join with him and other libertarians. I mean, not neoconservatives. There's a total difference.
Yeah.
Complete opposites, in fact. Libertarians like Ron Paul. There's no reason why leftists who are against war shouldn't join with these people to make a really effective anti-war movement.
Really?
But here come the anti-fascists. Oh, no, you mustn't touch them. You'll be contaminated. That's where this red-brown notion comes in.
Yeah, I was going to ask about
that. If you say anything halfway non-insulting about someone on the right, you're a fascist too. And so this scares people from making the kind of coalition that is drastically needed in order to fight the war machine.
Really? And I wanted to follow up on that point. Red-brown. What is that? That's a term they use to smear people. Red-brown. What is that?
Yeah, well, you see, we've had a big experience of it here in France. It's been a major tool in destroying anti-war movements here. Because all of the people, prominent, within the scope of the left writing and talking and so on, who are anti-war, end up at some point being associated with some conservative who's also against the war. And then he's described as a red-brown. That is to say, like red on the inside, but brown meaning fascist on the outside. You can't have anything to do with anybody who isn't totally against anybody on the right, which really ends up making anti-war movements impossible. And you see, this has been used. I put something in my article. I put an anecdote. It isn't the whole story, but I happen to know the story very well. So I included this anecdote because it illustrates what I mean, that people show up from nowhere and are really very eager to do the cause. But I saw that in the Vietnam War, too. I saw that in the Vietnam War. Somebody you never saw before suddenly comes up and is so zealous and more than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, that's the sign of an agent. And that happened here. This woman who got this blog and was constantly, we just lists of people that you mustn't have anything to do with because they were seen at a demonstration where there was also someone from the right, meaning
right.
Not and so this smear tactic of red brown is has been used a great deal here. I think it's beginning to wear off because it has been for the last 5 years precisely during these Middle East wars, Libya, so on and so. It was very strong there to prevent any people getting together. But I think there's a catching on to it now. I'm hoping that it's worn out, but it seems to be starting in over there.
No.
For once, the United States follows Europe instead of usually the other way around.
It saddens me to hear that culturally they're buying into so many American things. I'm reminded again of how you start your essay in Counterpunch with that quote from the Italian writer Ennio Flaiano. Fascists are divided into two categories, the fascists and the anti-fascists. We're proving that point so clearly here because it's so rigid, and that anybody daring to be outside that has got to be the enemy. I mean, I criticize the current government, some of the actions of the state of Israel. And I'm guessing Antifa would call me a fascist for that. You know, it's so incredibly close-minded. It just, I find this exceptionally troubling, too. You write, the government doesn't need to repress anti-war gatherings. Antifa does the job. Please explain what you mean.
They have absolutely done it here, and the last time there was a really big anti-war thing was in 2003 against the
Iraq War.
The Iraq War, and there were big demonstrations. And but then this campaign began about red brown and you're doing with this one and if you don't want to destroy a country, you're defending a dictator. I mean, Libya has been absolutely destroyed, and it's now. I don't need to go into details. Right. It couldn't be worse.
Yes,
it's absolutely horrible. I have been to Libya before. I know what it was like. I can compare. It was the richest country. I mean, the highest standard of living. I don't mean rich. You know, highest standard of living in Africa, and there was no beggars. I saw no police in the street. People were well off. Even in the bazaar, nobody was killing themselves to sell me something because they were desperate. I mean, it was a comfortable country to be in. It's now a shambles, a wreck.
Yeah.
And that, of course, was Hillary Clinton's war.
Absolutely. She owns that. Yep, I know.
And she was very proud of it.
Yes.
But by this time, the Antifa kind of propaganda was in full swing, and if you didn't want to murder the dictator and overthrow the government of the country, it was because you're a fascist because you like dictators.
But,
you know, the word dictator is another of these words like fascist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is very much overused because, you know, the world is full of different kinds of authoritarian government.
Yes.
Libya was a bit complicated. It actually had a sort of a Congress, and Gaddafi called himself a guide, not a dictator. You have kings. You have various types of government that aren't democratic. But it's now the custom has arisen to call any kind of government that the United States doesn't like a dictatorship. I mean, they called Milosevic of Serbia a dictator, and he was elected in probably the fairest elections in that part of Europe, in a particularly democratic way, where you had to get a full majority or they re-voted, in coalition government with a free press, which was attacking him all the time. And according to U.S. propaganda, he was a dictator. You're a dictator if the U.S. government wants to get rid of you. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
But everybody picks up on this. And then, of course, I wrote about Yugoslavia because I knew Yugoslavia very well. I had been a student in Yugoslavia. I visited. I could understand the language. I could read the press. Other people were writing about who didn't know anything, who didn't understand anything. And they gobbled up all the propaganda. And, of course, so we tore apart that country before going on to tear apart other countries. But I saw then just how the lies can work. And the newspapers, I was there, and I ended up being blackballed. Nobody would take my articles because they didn't follow the party line.
Hmm.
And I saw other people arriving who knew nothing, who couldn't understand a word of the language.
Right.
They went to the U.S. embassy, and the embassy would tell them what the story was.
Hmm. What to think, yes. Put in there, oh my goodness, 1984. There's so much more to talk about. You know, it amazes me how people in Antifa claim to be radical revolutionaries, but their mindset is perfectly typical of the atmosphere of violence which prevails in a heavily militarized America. That just, it's deeply troubling. And you write that it's not the obvious alt-right loonies, you know, the far-right, you know, lunatics, but as you say, the truly dangerous people in the United States are safely ensconced in Wall Street, in Washington think tanks, in the executive suites of the sprawling military industry, end of quote. And then Antifa is actually distracting us from the real fight any genuine left would wage. As you point out, the facile use of the term fascist, as we were just talking about, gets in the way of thoughtful identification and definition of the real enemy of humanity today. So they are doing the left some real harm, and they would say that we are not the real left. It just, it really amazes me, the militarism of it. You know, a lot of these young men who, if it weren't for Antifa, might go into, they want to be violent, they want to be bullies, they might go into the U.S. Marines. And this, you know, this violence solves everything. It's just stupid. I'm sorry. It really is ridiculous. Go ahead.
Well, it really is an echo of the mores of the U.S. government. They have the same thing. We don't talk, like, free speech. No, we mustn't talk, we must act, right?
Right.
Then, it's the same thing. Oh, you can't argue with a fascist being anybody that they might argue with. By the way, I'm not talking about the real loonies, so I don't particularly want to argue with them, but... I mean, they exclude speech as a way of finding compromise and understanding. That's exactly what the U.S. government does. It's the same thing. Now, we don't got to talk with a dictator. We'll just bomb him, right?
Right.
That seems to be the only way the United States government knows how to deal with people is to intimidate them, bomb them, sanction, get tough.
You have 1 minute remaining.
Have the same ethic. Exactly the same. And if that isn't close to fascism, I don't know what is.
It really is. Well, I just got noticed, you probably just heard, my calling card is running out. What can we do to fight real fascism? What would you suggest?
What?
What can we do?
You get together and with like-minded people and work on a program, and what are your specific demands, and how are you going to advance them, at what levels of the political system, and so on. And you work on strategy. Of course, the fact is strategy takes thought. And it may be that a lot of these young people are much better at fist fights than at thinking out strategy. I think that's the case. But that's when a little bit of self-criticism should come in and a little bit of self-education.
And it seems like we're still going here.
You have insufficient funds to continue the call.
Direct.
Welcome to Penny Talk.
Oh, no. Well, I hope you thought that was an interesting show. I did. Thank you, Diana Johnstone. Sorry we got cut off here. We have to do something here. We got to take on the Antifa. They are really, really hurting the left. I have no doubt they're being funded by the far right. They're so convenient to the people in power and to discredit the actual left. Well, thanks so much for listening. And we've been talking about rough boys.